And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy, because we're going to give you all that contact information later on in the show. Right now we're going to get on to our commentary. We do commentary every week. This one is Clues to the Redwood's Mighty Growth Emerge in Fog. This is written by Carol Kasuk Yoon, Y-O-O-N. And here we go. Always an awe-inspiring sight, the giant redwoods that tower along the California coast are perhaps at their majestic best on foggy days, when these ancients among the botanical wonders of the world can be glimpsed through wisps of swirling mist. But now scientists are learning that fog among the redwoods is more than just picturesque. They believe fog may be crucial to the well-being of these rapidly disappearing forests and an answer to the long-pondered question, why are the redwoods the tallest trees on Earth? Scientists have long known that when fog rolls into a redwood, water suspended in the fog begins dripping down the tree's limbs, needles, and trunk. But in a study to be published in January in the journal Ecologia, Dr. Todd Dawson, a plant ecologist at Cornell University and the University of California, Berkeley, has shown that this curious mechanism can provide an immense amount of water to the trees and to the ground around them. The study overturns a major piece of ecological dogma that plants steal water rather than contribute it to a habitat. In one foggy night, a single redwood can douse the ground around it with the equivalent of a drenching rainstorm, and the drops off redwoods can provide as much as half the water coming into a forest over a year. In fact, Dr. Dawson concluded, the redwood's ability to draw water from the fog appears crucial in maintaining the wet climate that redwoods and so many other species, some endangered, thrive in. Quote, plants aren't passive players out there, Dr. Dawson said. Quote, they're active in influencing their own environment. I've never been more wet in my life than I have been in a redwood forest during a major fog event. You're soaking wet when you're beneath one. Dr. Kathleen C. Waters, forest ecologist with the Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, New York, said, quote, this is really important, not just for redwoods, but for other plants. If you cut the redwoods down, you take away that structure that can intercept the fog and the water will pass right by. Conservationists working to save these charismatic trees, which can inspire people to the extremes of impassioned zeal, have long argued that fog drip is vital not only for plants but for endangered animal species, as well as the people who struggle to maintain water supplies in habitats that can see little or no rain in the summer. Coastal redwoods, or Sequoia sempervirens, are found patchily, mostly along California coast and into southern Oregon. Working in Northern California, Dr. Dawson measured the water dripping off redwoods and found artificial fog and off artificial fog collectors in forested and deforested areas. He found redwoods are extremely efficient producers of fog drip. In deforested areas, which warm up and dry out quickly, it is much more difficult to capture water from fog. Dr. Dawson also took advantage of the fact that not all water is created equal. Hydrogen and oxygen, the two components of water, come in different forms or isotopes. Fog water and rainwater can be distinguished from one another by the varying isotope ratios that they contain. Studying the isotopes in water in different plants, Dr. Dawson found that fog drip is an important source of water to redwoods as well as many other plants. He said sword ferns were at times entirely dependent on the water coming off of redwood trees. With redwoods thriving in a wet environment and thriving redwoods making the environment wetter, the interaction forms a positive feedback loop. Dr. Dawson said, even the handsome structure of the redwood may itself help with this feedback. Redwoods may have evolved their structure of many branches and an array of fine needles over eons because the complex structure so efficiently strips fog. Quote, this is a story that gets repeated in a lot of different environments around the world, Dr. Tom Hinckley, a forest biologist at the University of Washington, said of the interaction between fog and trees, quote, until now, these fog phenomena have been largely discounted. For local activists who live in and around redwood forests, scientific confirmation of their theories was good news. Quote, when you clear cut, you don't have any input from the fog, said Els Cooperreiter, a redwood conservationist and local radio talk show host, who said she has made fog drip a household word in Mendocino County. Quote, one of the reasons so many people around here have begun to listen to this phenomenon of fog drip is that they've seen their wells and springs dry up. Paul Carroll, lawyer for Friends of the Old Trees, a conservation group in California, said the group had already used fog drip as an arguing point to stop logging. Twice, the group prevented cutting in a redwood forest using the objection that the loss of water from fog drip was not addressed adequately in the logging plan that had been submitted. Conservationists are fighting a difficult battle as researchers say only 4% of the original redwood forest remains standing today, and a single old-growth redwood can contain wood worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Dr. Dawson said it remained an open question whether fog water he studied replenished streams or groundwater. Among those eager for answers are biologists interested in the fate of endangered species like coho salmon, whose streams run through redwood forests before reaching the sea. Quote, I can see this being hugely important, said Dr. Terry Rolfs, salmon stream ecologist at Humboldt State University in Arcata, California, explaining that the time coho spend in shallow drying streams in the summer can be a crucial bottleneck for these fish. If fog drip contributes to stream flows, that would be a real plus for these animals, he said. While new to biologists, the idea of fog can be a crucial source of water has in fact been around for some time. In coastal regions of South America and in Namibia, where fog is common but water is not, people build elaborate structures which function like redwood's many branches and needles to capture water from rolling banks of fog. Whatever else biologists may learn about redwoods, the most stunning thing about them remains their sheer jaw-dropping size. Dr. John Sawyer, what a name, vegetation ecologist at Humboldt State University, says the tallest tree alive in the world today is a 370-foot-tall redwood whose location biologists declined to disclose to protect its fragile habitat from visitors. But given the physical challenge of moving water up high leaves and branches, biologists have long wondered how redwoods achieve their fantastic size. Plants do not have an active pumping system to move water and depend instead upon the evaporation of water out of the leaves, an action that draws up more water from below. But this passive transport of water has to be strong enough to overcome the resistance within the pipe-like structures that transport water throughout a plant, and the taller the pipe, the greater the resistance. With too much resistance, a plant can suffer a break in the water column, which could stop the flow of water altogether. In a new book on redwoods scheduled to be published next fall by Island Press, Dr. Dawson has contributed to an article that suggests that the ability of redwoods to keep their environment so moist with fog water may reduce the rate at which they lose water and the rate at which water must move up through them, thereby reducing the water demands that keep other plants from growing to such great heights. In addition, Dr. Dawson said it was possible that redwoods are taking in fog water through their foliage, an ability that could greatly reduce their need to move quantities of water upward. Dr. Reed Noss, co-director of the Conservation Biology Institute and editor of the upcoming volume on redwoods, said that understanding the relationship between fog drip and the stupendous height of redwoods is more than a mere curiosity. It tells us something about restoration, said Dr. Noss. If it is the presence of a lot of big fog-stripping redwoods that allows redwoods to soar skyward, he asks, quote, once we deforest a site, how will we ever be able to grow these giants back? And that's our commentary for today. Clues to the Redwood's Mighty Growth Emerge in Fog, written by Carol Kasuk Yoon. Let's move right back into animal news. Cadmium poisoning widespread in Colorado wildlife is the headline. Almost half of the white-tailed ptarmigan in a large region of southern Rocky Mountains are suffering from acute cadmium poisoning and exposure to high concentrations of the toxic trace metal. Scientists reported in the journal Nature that 46% of the adult birds surveyed in a 10,000-square-kilometer area of south-central Colorado were found with cadmium accumulations in their kidneys well above a toxic threshold of 100 parts per million. Cadmium toxicity causes liver and kidney dysfunction, brittle bones, and affects reproduction and survival. Lead author James Larrison, an Oregon State University professor and alpine ecologist, said the findings are similar to those that linked the pesticide DDT to a problem of thin eggshells in the peregrine falcon 3 decades ago. The implications of the toxicity go beyond a single species. What we found in our study was that a particular genus of plants, willows, are biomagnifying or concentrating cadmium, Larrison said. They act as biological pumps, increasing the concentrations of cadmium by 2 orders of magnitude. That's 100 times. at least. Birds eat a lot of willow, especially in the winter when other foods are scarce. They aren't the only creatures that eat willow, though. The possibility exists that deer, elk, moose, snowshoe, rabbits, beaver, and other animals may face similar problems, just as it is possible that other plants, including some vegetables, may have the same abilities to biomagnify cadmium that willow does. Larison said the human health risk from eating ptarmigan is small unless the internal organs are consumed, but people could be at risk from eating vegetables grown in the area. Predators that rely on ptarmigan, including eagles, hawks, foxes, and coyotes, could end up with toxic doses of cadmium as well. Larison said extensive mining, which mobilizes toxic metals, had made the problem worse in Colorado. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to designate as critical habitat 2,566 acres of mostly state-owned land in western San Luis Obispo County, California, for the endangered Moro shoulder-band snail. The service is not proposing that roads or other developments within the broad boundaries of this proposal be included as critical habitat, said Michael Spear of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service California and Nevada Operations Office. This proposal will help ensure that federal agencies consult with the service when they undertake or permit activities in areas that are essential to the survival of the snail. The Moro shoulder-band snail, also known as the banded dune snail, was listed as endangered in 1994 due to habitat loss. The announcement came in response to a lawsuit filed by the Center for Biological Diversity and others. If you'd like to comment on the proposal, you can do so until September 11th. The address, FW1 Moro Snail at r1.fws.gov. That's FW1 Moro, M-O-R-R-O, Snail, and that's all one word, at r1.fws.gov. Reading on, ExxonMobil, whichever it is, threatens pristine Amazon Valley. The 350,000-acre Candamo Valley is considered one of the most biodiverse areas in the Peruvian Amazon. Because of the geography of the valley, it is surrounded by steep mountains and penetrated by one swift, narrow river. It is also one of the Amazon's least spoiled treasures. Whether the Candamo Valley remains this way will likely to be determined in the near future by the U.S.-based corporation ExxonMobil. 4 years ago, the Peruvian government granted Mobil and its partners Exxon and Elf. Mobil and Exxon have since merged the right to explore for oil and natural gas in the Candamo Valley and the surrounding region, an area known to the oil industry as Block 78. So far, Mobil has done only preliminary work in Candamo Valley, and its impact has been minimal. According to the Peruvian government, however, the results of Mobil's initial exploration indicate that the valley may hold large reserves of natural gas. The threat is particularly troubling given the unique natural resources of the Candamo Valley. It is home to a multitude of animal species, including jaguar, puma, tapir, anaconda, armadillo, and the endangered giant otter. In the span of just 2 years, biologists studying the area have identified 663 vertebrate species, a new species of fish, 426 species of birds. The valley is a complex, healthy, and intact ecosystem, a complete Amazon in miniature, according to some scientists. What can you do? Well, realizing that similar projects have devastated ecosystems throughout South America, resulting in the toxic pollution of air, soil, water, and massive deforestation, is it worth it? Is it worth sacrificing one of the last wild, pristine spots on Earth for a little natural gas? I don't think so. If you don't think so, write to Lee Raymond, Chief Executive Officer of ExxonMobil. His address, 5959 Las Colinas Boulevard, Irving, Texas, 75039. Once again, the address, Mr. Lee Raymond, Chief Executive Officer of ExxonMobil, 5959 Las Colinas, that's C-O-L-I-N-A-S, Boulevard, Irving, Texas, the zip, 75039. And North Dakota continues its prairie dog shoot. While some Great Plains states are moving to protect the declining black-tailed prairie dog in Shields, North Dakota, the 8th annual prairie dog extravaganza brought together 70 shooters to compete for $1,900 in prize money. According to the Associated Press, the event registered over 23,000 prairie dog kills. The report also noted the results of a CNN poll asking, why should the widespread killing of prairie dogs be allowed? With over 10,000 responses, 58% thought ranchers need to learn to coexist with prairie dogs. Many ranchers, however, feel that prairie dogs kill grass with their tunnels and prevent grazing. The land is going to be worth nothing, said rancher Richard Turns. On the other hand, environmentalists claim that prairie dogs end up improving the soil by aerating it and providing key nutrients. The North Dakota Game and Fish Department is looking at developing a plan to maintain the prairie dogs, but has yet to determine what a viable population is. But if they kill 23,000 a year, they may not have much to study. And in a related story, the black-footed ferret, one of North America's most endangered mammals, will return to tribal lands in South Dakota, perhaps as early as this fall. Under a proposed reintroduction by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in partnership with the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, ferrets would be reintroduced into two large black-tail prairie dog colonies on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation in Dewey and Zibach counties. Black-footed ferrets are dependent on large prairie dog colonies for food and shelter, and biologists believe the Cheyenne River colonies could support up to 900 ferrets. Sounds like good news. If you want more information, go to mountain-prairie.fws.gov/ferret and check around in there for their 71800.pdf. Once again, mountain-prairie.fws.gov/ferret/71800.pdf. PDF. What the hell? Try it. Maybe you'll like it. And in response to a court order, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to designate almost 13 million acres of federal and tribal lands in Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah as critical habitat for the threatened Mexican spotted owl. 90% of the area proposed for designation is on federal lands, while 10% is on tribal lands. The proposal includes no state or private lands. While the service is proposing 13.5 million acres of critical habitat for the Mexican spotted owl, not all the areas within those broad boundaries have element habitats important to the owl, said Nancy Kaufman, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Southwest Regional Director. Based on the results of consultations, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does not expect the proposed designation of critical habitat to affect activities such as thinning trees less than 9 inches in diameter, fuels reduction to reduce the risk of wildfowl, fire, personal use commodity production such as fuel wood, latilias, and vigas, and Christmas tree cutting, livestock grazing in upland habitats, and most recreation activities including hiking, camping, fishing, hunting, cross-country skiing, off-road vehicle use, and various wildlife observation activities. If you want to comment on any of this, you can contact the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Southwest Regional Office. I don't have an address in this notice, but comments will be taken until September 21st. Critical habitat has been proposed for a Texas plant. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to designate the critical habitat of the Zapatista bladder pod, an endangered plant known only to exist in South Texas. The critical habitat would include a quarter-mile stretch of highway right-of-way at each of two sites along Highway 83 in Zapata County, Texas. In Starr County, seven areas, totaling 5,330 acres in the lower Rio Grande Valley National Wildlife Refuge and a 1.36-acre site on private land are being considered for habitat critical habitat designation. The Zapata bladder pod is a rare member of the mustard family, the rarest plant species in Texas. It is a silver-green plant with stems 17 to 34 inches long, narrow leaves 1 to an inch and a half long, bright yellow flowers appearing with significant rainfall throughout most of the year, and there are 10 populations of the Zapata bladder pod found since 1959. Of those 10, only 4 are still known to exist. Comments on the critical habitat designation are accepted until September 18th, and once again, I don't have an address for those comments, but try and figure out where the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Southwestern Regional Director Nancy Kaufman is, and you can probably take your comments to her. And developer barred from stripping gnatcatcher habitat, a federal court has issued a preliminary injunction against Granite Homes for a housing project now underway in Elsinore, California, to protect threatened birds. The ruling will prevent any further vegetation clearing or construction on the property until the court action is concluded. The coastal California gnatcatcher was listed as a threatened species in 1993. Much of its sage scrub habitat has disappeared or become fragmented because of development. Field studies conducted by consultants for the developer observed gnatcatchers using habitat on 44 of the lots scheduled for development. So that's good news from Southern California. Hopefully they'll get their permanent injunction on that one. And here's some bad news. British scientists are concerned that the jumping gene used to genetically modify organisms could spread to other species, New Scientist magazine states. The so-called Mariner element had jumped species at least 7 times in evolutionary history, according to a report commissioned by the British government. In a project for the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food, Andy Brass and his 2 colleagues at the University of Manchester compared the DNA of 80,000 different organisms using 5 million sequences, the Weekly magazine said. They found 7 pairs of similar Mariner sequences. The scientists said there was strong suggestive evidence that the gene moved between the tsetse fly and humans. They also suspect it crossed over to a mosquito, bee beetle, and a cat flea. By using it to insert genes into animals or plants, the researchers fear it could spread into other species. But the scientists who are using Mariner in GM organisms played down potential risk. We can engineer things so the risk is acceptably small, David Finnegan, the University of Edinburgh, told the magazine. Acceptably small danger? What's an acceptably small danger? Well, Uncle Dennis doesn't have any clue about that. Danger is danger as far as I'm concerned. The spotted owl is continuing to disappear in the Pacific Northwest. For 5 years, the owl's population rate of decline has slowed from 4.5% to 3.9% a year, but in some areas, such as the forest near Glendale, Oregon, the spotted population may be stable, while in others, like Washington's Olympic Peninsula, the population is plummeting. Still, the owl population is falling more quickly than the 1% annual decline predicted in the Northwest Forest Plan, an alarming development for forest activists. Well, we have a little more time here. Japan has defied international protests by sending on a mission to catch 160 whales, claiming it was for research purposes. Critics say the 2-month expedition to catch sperm and bride's whales is a cover for commercial whaling, which was banned by the International Whaling Commission in 1986. A limited number of whale hunting trips for research is allowed, but both Tony Blair and President Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of England, and President Bill Clinton have urged the Japanese government to abandon the expedition, with the White House saying that sanctions are a possibility. They haven't happened yet. 4 Japanese whaling vessels have set sail for the Northwest Pacific Ocean, according to Japan's Kyoto News Agency, quoting officials from the Fisheries Agency. The report said the scientists would examine the whales to collect data on their habitats and migration patterns, and then the meat would be sold. At a recent G8 summit in Japan, both Clinton and Blair urged Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihiro Mori to cancel the expedition. The World Wildlife Fund has called for sanctions against Japan, saying the nation's research is merely a guise used to expand a banned commercial whale hunt. And Sue Fisher of the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society said Japan has made a defiant and aggressive move that, if unchecked, could lead to a further expansion of whaling. The president of the International Fund for Animal Welfare, Fred O'Regan, said, This decision is a slap in the face of Clinton, Blair, and many others who have been working to persuade Japan to cancel its plans to kill more whales. Japan killed more than 400 minke whales last year. Whale meat is considered a delicacy in Japan, and the oils from sperm whales are used in cosmetics and perfume. And that's just about all the time Uncle Dennis has for news today. To get your news and announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance, please. 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address for the moment is Post Office Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And you can listen to Earth First Radio on your computer. We're streaming audio at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. And that is live every Thursday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Or you can catch us later on for the archive shows. Those are at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need to play the MP3 files is free on either website. but only good for those websites. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations, so please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and prepared by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. This is Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. We'll be back next week with more news, but now let's listen to some music off of a CD called If a Tree Falls. This one is called Defend the Earth. It's by Alice DiMicelli.
Just do something to defend.